Welcome to the New Books in East Asia podcast series. My name is Nathan Hobson, and today I'm going to be talking with Laura Neitzel about her book, The Life We Longed For, Danchi Housing and the Middle Class Dream in Post-War Japan. It's out 2016 from Merwin Asia. Laura Neitzel's The Life We Longed For, Danchi Housing and the Middle Class Dream in Post-War Japan is a chronicle of the large government-sponsored housing projects called Danchi that were built during Japan's high-growth years, roughly 1955 until the first oil shock in the early 1970s. Though only a minority of Japanese lived in the Danchi, they took on an outsized place in the public imagination of and aspirations for the ideal new bright life of post-war Japan. The Danchi, which, as Laura will explain, were built by the Japan Housing Corporation, the JHC, to accommodate the rush of families relocating to the cities during this transformational period, were the symbol of a new democratic middle-class life freed from the quote-unquote feudal past, a great social and architectural experiment and the source of enormous social cathexis. Drawing on a wide range of sources, from government white papers to popular women's magazines, and paying close attention to the Danchi as an everyday revolution of the everyday, to both the positive and negative views in society of the Danchi, and to their relationship to contemporaneous social imaginaries of the democratic capitalist affluence around the world, Neitzel paints a really clear and concise portrait of the Danchi as aspiration, but also paradoxically as a kind of nostalgia, a longed-for life that never really was. The book provides a clear and sensitive look at Danchi as modern design and design for modernity, as a fantasy of middle-class life and a middle-class fantasy, warts and all. Hello, my name is Nathan Hobson, and welcome to the New Books in East Asia podcast series. Today we have with us Laura Neitzel, and we're going to be discussing her book, The Life We Longed For, Danchi Housing and the Middle-Class Dream in Post-War Japan. Laura, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Nathan. I'm thrilled to be here.
Great. We're going to just start off with a quick question about how you got to this project. Because, I have this feeling like Danchi are one of those things that are so obvious that they're almost kind of transparent. And people, it's such an obviously important subject, but it's so easily overlooked. So I'm really fascinated to hear how you got interested in this project and like how you got through it. Also a little bit about who you are, where you're from, where you went to school.
Sure. So I can start with the second part. I'm currently the academic director at the Committee on Global Thought and a lecturer in history at Columbia University. And I also did my PhD studies at Columbia. I came to this project as my dissertation project out of an interest in the early post-war period and really a kind of large question about how Japan began to create new meanings after defeat, brought meaning to everyday life. And so I became really interested in less the occupation period than the period just after that and on the cusp of high-speed growth and the ways especially within popular culture, people were beginning to articulate new visions for a future and how even concepts of the past were either woven within that or kind of left behind. And I took into my research a very broad concept that there was a kind of Americanization of everyday life that was going on, and that through new consumption and new family relations that people were finding different kinds of meaning in life. And everywhere I turned, because it's a very kind of vague thing to begin researching, I began to find Danchi. And I actually started my research with an investigation of the Danchi that began to be built by the Japan Housing Corporation in 1955 and very quickly kind of captured the imagination of people in Japan. You could see them in magazines, women's magazines, and in all sorts of places, people looking at the Danchi, talking about the Danchi as a kind of very modern, cutting-edge, modern lifestyle. So because I had started with such a broad and vague concept of what I wanted to do, the Danchi were something quite literally concrete. So I began my investigations there, and I realized that through this kind of very concrete real site, I was able to investigate all sorts of questions about both how people were re-envisioning middle-class life, but also how they were kind of seeing this new post-war life in relationship to wartime and the early post-war. So as I began the research, I realized that, wow, this could actually be the project. And so I ended up looking at the Danshi from lots of different perspectives, from the perspective of housing history, from the perspective of city planning, from the perspective of popular culture. You know, even my favorite part of the project was looking at novels and films and short stories that were written about the Danshi or situated in the Danshi to really think about the many meanings of the Danshi in post-war Japan.
Okay, great. Yeah. And that's really interesting. And I guess I was listening and I felt like we've done one of those horrible things. And it's entirely my fault to our listeners, where we've been throwing around this word Danshi. And I suppose we have, a number of people listening to the podcast now who are wondering, what the heck are Danshi? So I guess we should sort of jump back to that question. And I should have asked that first. So we've been talking about Danshi. Can you tell us a little bit about what they are? And in the bigger sense, sort of like, I know your book is about what they mean, and we'll get to that in a second. But just physically, what were the Danshi?
What they are. So they are, the most basic answer is that they're large apartment-style housing complexes, and you're absolutely right. They're ubiquitous on the landscape in Japan. You know, you pass them on the trains, you pass them on the streets, your friends live in them, you might have lived in one. They're kind of everywhere. And the term Danshi is a kind of generic term now to refer to that style of housing. But in fact, it was the Japan Housing Corporation in the mid-1950s that kind of popularized this term and kind of, as I argue, Danshi-ized the Danshi or brought kind of meaning to the concept of Danshi. And the Japan Housing Corporation was a public corporation that was formed in 1955 and mandated to increase housing stock. And so their real purpose was to be a solution to what was a continuing housing crisis coming out of World War II. And like much of the world, where this was kind of the high point in mass social housing in many parts of the world, it was seen as a quick and relatively cheap way to provide housing in the midst of vast shortages in any part of the world that was impacted by the war directly and even indirectly. You know, here in the United States as well, we had a huge housing shortage coming out of World War II. You know, in the case of Japan, over half of the homes in urban areas and a fifth of them nationwide were lost in the war. New housing construction halted during the war. And then after the war, you had millions being repatriated from the battlefields and from the empire. So then in 1945, Japan had a shortage of 4.2 million housing units. And even 10 years later, when the Japan Housing Corporation was founded, it had not been really ameliorated that much. And part of that was due to then economic growth, where people were starting to really move into the cities in larger and larger numbers. So in 1955, there was still a shortage of 3 million housing units. So, you know, the basic answer is that it's apartment-style housing as a solution. But then what makes the Danshi so interesting is that they were really quite innovative for their time. They were the first to introduce the DK configuration. And again, those folks who are familiar with Japanese housing or have lived in Japanese housing know right away what that is. DK stands for dining kitchen, and it's the kind of shorthand for articulating spatial layouts, especially for rental housing or for even some for condominiums in some cases, 1DK, 2DK, 1LDK, if you want to put a living room in there. And this kind of terminology originated with the Danshi. They were the first to put in mass-produced stainless steel sinks in the kitchens, which are to this day quite common. And that was seen as really modern and made, you know, the kitchen a kind of very hygienic, modern seeming space. They were the first to really, on a mass scale, have baths within an apartment unit and Western style toilets. And so they were really quite appealing to people in the mid-50s, especially at a time, you know, I've had many people say to me, you know, we have this narrative of the 50s as the post-war's finally over, that saying, or that, you know, phrase that came out of a famous white paper, government white paper in 1955, Mohaya Sengo Dewa Nai, or Sengo, yes, that Mohaya, the post-war is finally over. But in fact, you'll have people, you know, I had many people saying to me who lived through those years, Sengo was not over. I mean, people's living conditions were still quite dire. There was still a true housing crisis even in the 1950s. So the Danchi were seen not only as a solution, but a very kind of modern, cutting edge one, and therefore people's longing to live in the Danchi.
Yeah, thank you so much. And that actually brings me really quite nicely into the next question that I had. You know, your title is The Life We Longed For. And you just brought up this question of longing. I wonder if you could unpack that a little bit for us. So, like, where did the title come from? And what is this longing that you're talking about?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. It took me a really long time to come to this title. And then once I settled, I mean, this was not the title of my dissertation. And it took me a long time to get to it. And then once I decided that this was the title, it really clicked for me, and it had been sitting, you know, in front of me all the time, because this phrase, the life we longed for, or in Japanese, akogareta seikatsu, is really one of the reasons why I became so intrigued with the Danchi, because whenever I would read about the Danchi, really starting from the 50s on, but even today, when you read about the Danchi, it's kind of the Danchi, it was the life we longed for. Or when you speak to people and I'd say, oh, I'm researching the Danchi, they'd say, oh, that was the life we longed for. So it was this phrase, I was really intrigued by that, you know, like, what does this mean? And even, you know, in the 1990s and the early 2000s, people are saying, oh, that was the life we longed for. But in fact, it people's lives by the time you get, you know, to the 1990s had so kind of surpassed the lifestyle and the living standards of the Danchi. So it really intrigued me, this phrase. And then it really clicked for me as a title when I began to try to think about the Danchi within a more globalized context and really realize that, A, the story of mass housing, but also the story of kind of middle-class dreams being rearticulated and enacted in different ways after World War II, especially with mass consumption becoming more common in different parts of the world, that the life we longed for was not just a Japanese phenomenon, that the life that people in Japan longed for was in many ways the life my parents longed for as they had emerged both from the experience of the Great Depression and World War II, you know, a comfortable home, a place to raise children, in the case of the United States, you know, life in the suburbs, and a life filled with all of these, you know, the television and all of these appliances that made your daily life easier. So, and that's when it clicked for me, because it's not just the life we long for as a translation of akogareta seikatsu, but it was the life, it's a kind of statement, I think, that very much is of the moment that the Japanese call high-speed economic growth. But I think that's a global high-speed economic growth between the 50s and the 70s, and came with a lot of new visions of what daily life should look like.
Yeah, and I want to stick with this question of longing just a little bit more, because you've also brought up the very sort of innovative nature of the Danchi, and in your book you talk about nostalgia, right? This idea of the akogareta seikatsu, the, you know, the life that we longed for. But you also, and in particular, you bring in Svetlana Boym's ideas about nostalgia. Mm-hmm. But you also have Harry Harutunian talking about this idea of, you know, being filled with the future, right? And you have the Danchi are both filled with the future and at the same time an object of nostalgia, even almost in their own time. And I thought that was really interesting. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about that, about this sort of the fact that they're an aspiration, and sort of the temporality of that aspiration.
I think that that's really the key. And it really occurred to me recently that although I started out intrigued with this Danchi space, and especially the ways that architects were trying to, in a way, solve these social problems through space, that was where I started, that where I ended up, and of course that never goes away and you can't separate that from temporality, but where I ended up was with being very, very interested in time and temporality and just the idea of a future. And a feeling of futurity, if you want to call it that, the Heratunian's idea of being filled with the future. So that, and that's, I think, what I was trying to capture about Japan at this moment of high-speed economic growth. It was a feeling that there is a future and that it's certainly better than the past, you know, the wartime past and, right. and the time of recovery. And so it was a kind of hopefulness about what was possible. And it became very a kind of well-defined idea of what a middle-class life should look like. And there's so much wonderful work on this. But, you know, that you wanted to go to a good university, you wanted to, you know, you wanted to provide good education for your children so they could go to a good university so that they could get the good job, you know, the whole salaryman life, which really, you know, and I kind of lived through the tail end of that middle class dream, I think, living in Japan in the 1980s and things. It kind of felt like what Japan was to the world as well, but that it was very much of a very particular moment. And I think that this is very much in keeping with even a lot of the conversations we're having here in the United States right now about, you know, the middle class dream. Is my life going to be better than my parents' life? That's always been the kind of middle class dream here in the United States, one of the ways that we define it. And that's seeming less likely for many people these right. days. So right. that, you know, this the Danchi were of this time, and they kind of capture that, you know, that feeling. So that the nostalgia that we have going on about the Danchi in Japan today, which I tried to write a little bit about in the last chapter of the book, is not nostalgia for the brand new washing machine or whatever, but that nostalgia. The nostalgia is for that feeling of development and of a future, of a tomorrow that's better than today.
Yeah, I think that was one of the things that really struck me about the book was this connection between the future, what did you call that? The futurity, was it? Of the sort of idea of the high growth era and the sort of Danchi as a particularly, you know, a product particularly of that era. One thing that you just brought up in your answer there was this idea of the sort of ideal Sarariman, you know, white collar father, you know, professional housewife, mother, two kids who are both, you know, doing well in school, that sort of, that vision of a particular kind of consumeristic, bright life that was part of the vision of the high growth era. But one thing that sort of struck me in the book is, you were talking about the gendering of the Danchi, and in particular about the sort of spaces that were carved out for individual family members, right? So that in a way, like the Sarariman, we talk about the Sarariman family, and yet the Danchi is almost a place where there's no place for the Sarariman himself. And this was sort of really interesting to me. So I wonder if you could talk about the sort of the gendered aspect of the Danchi and like how the family unit was conceived of and worked within that those structures.
Well, for me, that, you know, the discussion really needs to start with what I have in my first chapter, which was the early post-war and a lot of the ideas that architects were exchanging about living space. And I kind of call this the kind of pre-intellectual history of the Danchi, because obviously that space gets designed later. But and when you had asked me before why I became interested in this project, this was another reason. You know, I'm not an architectural historian, so I didn't have a background in architecture, but I was very intrigued as I started to look at, you know, different discourses about living space, that, you know, early post-war architects, many of them were debating the very same things that other, you know, intellectuals were debating, you know, broadly about women's rights, about, you know, the need to change the family or democratize the family, the need to kind of rid Japan of, quote, feudal elements, you know, these kind of shards of the past still lodged in the present. And it was so intriguing to me to then see architects having these very same debates, but then saying, but we can fix this with space. And so, you know, one example, of course, is that, you know, elevating the women within the home, and also really kind of challenging the concept of the family system and the kind of patriarchal family system. And so architects and other critics were quite critical of wide open Japanese spaces with, you know, multi-generation families, where then the family patriarch would have this kind of visual, you know, surveillance capability of visual surveillance of the family.
Right.
And said that what we needed were people in order to foster individuality is everyone needs their own room. And then you also need to have shared living spaces where you can kind of practice democracy at the level of the family. Mm-hmm. And you also needed to kind of elevate the position of the woman by making spaces that were, you know, always traditionally associated with the woman, particularly the kitchen, to make it a clean, bright space and a place where the family gathers, not just a place where the woman cooks and then serves the family in a different room, but where the family gathers. And so these were a lot of the ideas that were actually behind the, you know, design of the danchi. And the idea was that these were going to be really kind of revolutionary ideas. And so then to me, it's really quite interesting how later, once this takes built form, that then there's this kind of real critique that now the women are the queen of the danchi. And remember, a lot of this is at the level of discourse and social critique, right? And I'm sure that a lot of men surely enjoyed their danchi space as much as the women did. But this kind of stereotype of all of the men heading off to work in their identical suits and all the women with their little house dresses waving them off, and then the men, you know, coming home late at night after going out with the other salarymen and you know, going to the wrong apartment because they all are identical, you know, all of these. And actually, that's the kind of trope that you see around the world of that kind of cookie cutter, mass produced middle class life in suburbia. You see that that kind of critique in Japan as well. So yes, the idea that women, and especially, and there was some truth to this, right? Because the danchi were being built in the suburbs, and you know, if you have the professional housewife, she was there, kind of stuck at home, and the workplace was far away, and so the husband gets home late at night, and so there become these kind of feminized realms, and then this idea that the husband doesn't have a space in the home.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up chapter one, right, which is called The Revolution of Everyday Life. And I thought that was a really great way to, you know, start off with this idea of sort of redesigning life, you know, in a very, as you said, quite literally concrete sense. And also, you know, this idea that we can, you know, fix what's wrong with the old feudal Japan. And this idea of sort of, you know, democracy at the level of building, I thought was a really powerful way to get us into the book. But you've started to talk
could I just add something to that real quickly, because I think the other piece of it is then, and probably the more profound piece in the long run, was the idea that that coming out of the war, that, you know, people's daily lives had been devastated, and here was an opportunity for people to really rebuild their everyday lives and their private lives, and with this, and really a critique of an idea that the state had intruded on the realm of everyday life throughout the war and before, actually from Meiji on. And so that this was a real moment of potentially a kind of radical reconfiguration, not just of the home and relationships within the home, but just what everyday life means. And so a true revolution in everyday life, not a revolution in everyday life that in the way that we're going to see the same phrase used in the 1960s to refer to, you know, the washing machine and the rice cooker and all of those appliances creating a revolution, a kind of consumptionist revolution of, in everyday life. The original kind of concept was as a potential for a radical transformation.
Yeah, and thank you for clarifying that. And this actually brings me to another question I wanted to ask, which is that, you know, we've talked about the Danshi being the product of a particular time, which is this era of high growth. And as many people know about Japan, that era of high growth is basically, you know, depending on how you look at it, it's from roughly 1955 until the first oil shock in the early 70s. But by the end of that period already, you were seeing, and you've alluded to some of this already, some significant backlash against the Danshi as these, you know, very disruptive forces. And you have a sort of, you know, and you've just mentioned consumption as one aspect of sort of what was wrong with Danshi, that there were cultural critics who felt like it was part of this movement to create a, you know, create a consumer lifestyle based on privacy, you know, these questions of privacy that were somehow tearing apart the fabric of what was good about, you know, quote unquote, traditional Japan. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, and I think that some of those critiques were of the moment as well, so that they're not all just happening, bursting out in the 70s. But I do think the 70s are a kind of a moment of reassessment, especially with the oil shocks of the 70s and other things, and people beginning to really assess with pollution and other issues, the very high cost paid for the decade and a half of high speed growth. And there were something very real here in terms of housing being an hour and a half, 2 hours from a workplace. Land prices rising, making housing and of course, you know, homes, not just, you know, apartment housing. We're talking about that, but, you know, the apartment housing was supposed to be a step toward owning a home, right? So, right. You know, the expense of that and the toll on daily life that took in order to achieve what was the actual real middle class dream, which was that home ownership. And also a feeling like that original concept of a revolution in everyday life had been betrayed by this other idea of revolution in everyday life that, you know, we're just kind of filled with houses, filled with appliances, but how does this change anything? And in fact, we might not be sacrificing our lives for the state anymore, but now in order to maintain this lifestyle, we're sacrificing our lives to a corporation. So there is a kind of multi-layered critique of housing, lifestyle, you know, the rabbit hutch, but also the meanings of everyday life and a kind of disappointment with how things have turned out by the time we get to the 70s. And I remember, you know, when I first went to Japan in the 70s, people would say to me all the time, like, yes, our country is rich, but we are poor. You know, look at our little house, you know. Yeah. And so this was very much internalized by people, this idea that their living standards were not where they should be.
Yeah, this is actually particularly poignant for me as I'm for the first time in my life just recently bought a house, and it's here in Japan. And
congratulations.
Thank you. I'm moving from an apartment to a house that's actually smaller than the apartment. If you
very interesting.
That. Yeah, it's very interesting. But, you know, one of the things I was thinking about, you know, I'm originally from Pennsylvania, and I have a friend of mine who's from Levittown.
Yes.
And we've talked about, you know, his experience in Levittown, and I've read up a little bit about that. And I'm not sure it's entirely fair to compare the Danshi to Levittown, both in terms of their sort of suburban, aspirational, post-war, you know, model, sort of aspirational lifestyle. But it occurred to me that that was at least a useful way for me to get my head around what you were talking about. What do you think about that?
And it's a very useful way to communicate this project to others, especially people in the United States. Yes. You know, in many ways they were different. I mean, Danshi housing, this was apartment housing. It was rental housing. And right. Again, it was meant to be a kind of temporary step to home ownership, although a lot of people live a whole life in the Danshi, but that was kind of the intention. and, you know, Levitt Hit Town, those were little freestanding houses. But in terms of the way that Levitt Town captured American social imaginary and became the kind of synonym for a kind of mass-produced middle-class life, I think that there are lots of comparisons to be made. And it is a very useful way for me to kind of communicate my project. But also, I mean, I think that it's another kind of illustration of these phenomena, you know, these types of housing and these types of lifestyles that the housing represented being really something that was happening in a lot of places at the same time.
Mm-hmm. We've taken up quite a bit of your time, and I just wanted to sort of at the end here transition. I had a quick question for you. You said at the outset that you are the academic director for the Committee on Global Thought at Columbia. Could you tell us a little bit about what it is that you're doing? What does that job entail?
Sure. Well, the Committee on Global Thought is a really wonderful enterprise at Columbia. It's a committee, actually, of faculty members drawn from across the university who have been tasked by the president of the university with really thinking about not only the role of the university in the 21st century, but how we even create knowledge or try to understand our complicated and interconnected world. And, you know, whether, you know, our current disciplinary boundaries, et cetera, and how those work with trying to conceptualize connection and where our world is today. And so this group that's drawn from across the university, you know, tackles questions together from the perspective of science, from history, from, you know, social science. And so we have a lot of research projects that we sponsor, but we also have a master's program in global thought, which is growing. We're in our fourth year, and we're also developing undergraduate curriculum, which is one of my main jobs is developing undergraduate curriculum in global thought. For the Committee on Global Thought. So it's a really interesting place to be, and it's very much suited to my own interests, which are global, and I tried to achieve this at least a little bit in this book, mm-hmm. to try and really think about the ways in which this story is one that is bigger than Japan and connected to sets of processes that were if not global, at least held in common by a lot of the developed nations in the world in the early years after World War II.
Well, that sounds like a really great place to work. I'm a little jealous. Well, thank you so much, Laura. I really appreciate it.
Come visit us.
Well, anytime. I would love to.
Sure.
Thank you so much for spending some time with us today and for talking about your book. I really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.